Hello, it's Friday the 13th of May and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. North Korea has confirmed its first COVID-19 death a day after admitting its first case. And the regime is reporting 18,000 new cases of fever as well. We'll have more on this escalating situation in our news briefing shortly. Later, we'll be discussing the 22-year record jobs growth for the month of April for Weekly Economy Review, as well as the new government's record supplementary budget. And then coming up for Movie Spotlight, we have reviews of the World War II British spy drama Operation Mincemeat and a local family dramedy called Piggyback. Let's begin, Korea 24. North Korea confirmed its first official death from COVID-19 on Friday, a day after it admitted its first ever outbreak in the regime. The new government in South Korea has been quick to offer aid. For more on this situation and the rest of the day's headlines, our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin, joins us in the studio. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So now, as we mentioned on this show yesterday, there are concerns that this will have major detrimental repercussions as North Korea is severely lacking in public healthcare infrastructure, especially outside the capital, Pyongyang. But first, what can you tell us about the situation in North Korea, what they've revealed so far anyway?
Well, according to the North's official Korean Central News Agency on Friday, the National Emergency Quarantine Command reported some 187,000 people are receiving treatment in isolation, with 18,000 or 10% of that total of these cases of fever reported the previous day alone. This comes after the isolationist state claimed for more than 2 years that it was pandemic-free after locking down its borders in early 2020. The agency reported 6 deaths, one of whom tested positive for the highly transmissible Omicron variant, and it said the country has seen a soaring number of undetermined cases of high fever nationwide since April, totaling around 350,000 in that short period of time, with 162,000 now fully recovered. This indicates that the variant may be more widespread than official figures released by the regime. The state agency said that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un visited the state emergency epidemic prevention headquarters on Thursday, and that he noted the widespread fever revealed holes in the country's quarantine system, calling for stringent measures to block the spread of the virus.
And here in South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol said that the nation stands ready to offer North Korea relevant humanitarian aid, vaccines and medical supplies.
Indeed. Our presidential spokesperson Kang In-sun said details of the aid plan will be decided through negotiations with the North, which claimed until this week to have no cases of COVID-19 in the country. Another official from the top office who declined to be identified told reporters that the situation in the North is worse than reported and that they are aware of the realities that have not yet been revealed to the public. The official said the North has not yet asked the South for assistance, but that Seoul remains ready to respond at any time, as it believes in the principle of separating humanitarian aid from military and security issues. The South has reached out to the North at the working level regarding this and other matters, he said.
Despite this brewing crisis, North Korea continued its provocations, as we briefly mentioned in our breaking report yesterday. More information has come out since then. South Korea's military has said North Korea fired 3 short-range ballistic missiles from the Sunan area in the capital towards the East Sea on Thursday. South Korea's presidential office called for a late-night emergency meeting and slammed the latest launch. Can you tell us more about the missiles?
Well, South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said on Thursday that it detected missiles launched at around 6:29 p.m., adding that they flew 360 kilometers with a maximum altitude of 90 kilometers and a top speed of Mach 5. The Presidential National Security Office in Seoul convened an emergency meeting and slammed North Korea, adding that the government deplored North Korea's two-faced actions in continuing to carry out ballistic missile provocations while neglecting its people's lives and safety amid the spread of the virus. The missiles may have been launched from what the North calls a super large multiple rocket launcher at intervals of about 20 seconds. The launches were the North's 16th act of provocation this year.
Two things to note. President Yoon reportedly did not attend that emergency meeting here in South Korea. And so far, there has been no reports on North Korean state media over this latest provocation. Meanwhile, the launch prompted a flurry of discussion between top diplomats and security advisers of South Korea and the US. Can you give us more details on the discussions?
Of course, Foreign Minister Park Jin, on his second day on the job on Friday, held his first video conference with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. They both strongly condemned North Korea's string of provocations, including its missile launch the previous day, and agreed to maintain the alliance, their alliance defense posture and bolster coordination against such threats. According to the Foreign Ministry, the two officials also reiterated they remain open to dialogue with Pyongyang and jointly committed to a principled, consistent pursuit of negotiations with the North. They also voiced concerns over the first confirmed outbreak of COVID-19 in North Korea and agreed to continue discussing ways to provide humanitarian aid in cooperation with the international community. National Security Advisor Kim Sung-hwan, who chaired the emergency meeting at the presidential office late on Thursday, held his first phone conversation with his U.S. counterpart, Jake Sullivan, immediately afterwards, both also expressing similar concerns. The two also agreed that U.S. President Joe Biden's upcoming visit to South Korea will provide a crucial opportunity for Seoul and Washington to tighten their comprehensive strategic partnership and agree to continue coordination for Biden's visit to be a success.
Moving on from North Korea, President Yoon said that South Korea will contribute an additional $300 million to a global initiative against COVID-19. As he made his debut on the international stage virtually during a second global COVID-19 summit. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the president made the pledge in his pre-recorded speech for the virtual summit co-hosted by the US, Belize, Germany, Indonesia and Senegal. In his first appearance on the international stage since Tuesday's inauguration, Yoon said South Korea will continue its contribution to the global effort to end the pandemic as the nation seeks to fulfill its responsibility and roles. The South Korean president said Seoul will contribute an additional $300 million to Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator, or ACT-A, a global initiative launched by the World Health Organization and various partners to collaborate on vaccines, treatments and tests for COVID-19. South Korea has so far provided $210 million in cash or goods to that initiative. Yoon also voiced active support for developing countries' efforts to produce vaccines.
Meanwhile, South Korea announced it will further increase the number of international flights amid the improving COVID-19 situation and rising demand for overseas travel. Can you give us more details?
Yes, the Minister of Interior and Safety, Lee Sang-min, who was appointed just yesterday, said in a meeting of the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters on Friday that the government will increase weekly flights by 230 through June instead of 100, which was the initial plan. Lee added that the government will streamline procedures for inbound travellers. He said that starting from May 23rd, the government will include rapid antigen tests among valid results that overseas travellers must submit before entering the nation in a bid to improve travellers' convenience and help alleviate costs. Starting from June 1st, the government would reduce the frequency of tests that overseas travellers must receive before and after they enter the nation from 3 to 2. The government also plans to allow travellers to submit PCR test results within 3 days of entering the country instead of presenting results on the day they land, starting the same day.
And finally, daily COVID-19 cases fell by more than 3,000 to stay below 40,000 amid a downward trend in infections. Can you give us the latest figures?
Of course, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency on Friday reported 32,451 additional cases, bringing the cumulative total to 17,727,086. The number of critically ill patients dropped by 7 from a day ago to 347, down 94 from the daily average the previous week. Thursday saw 52 deaths, raising the death toll to 23,606.
That's all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Next up, it's Weekly Economy Review, where we take a look at some of the key economy-related stories from the week in Korea. Today, we're looking at Korea's latest jobs data after April saw the biggest jump in jobs in 22 years. We'll also discuss the record 59 trillion won extra budget that has been proposed by the new Yoon administration. And we look at the US consumer prices, which slowed last month. To get some expert analysis on these issues, we're joined in the studio by economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, hello.
Hello.
Okay, let's start with that remarkable jobs growth data, remarkable looking anyway. Statistics Korea said on Wednesday that the number of employed people last month totaled nearly 28.08 million. That's up 865,000 from a year earlier. And it is the biggest on-year job growth in 22 years for the month of April. That's since the year 2000. But, Professor, what do you read into this data?
Okay, well, in terms of raw numbers, it really was a very good report. As you mentioned, the number of employed people are 28,008,000. That's the highest in recent history. In fact, I've been going back through the numbers, and I haven't seen any time when it was higher. Now, employment rate, it was 62.1%. So 62.1% of people aged 15 or above have jobs. Unemployment rate is 3.0%. These numbers are not only substantial improvement over last year's numbers. I tend to distrust numbers that came from during the pandemic. But even comparing it with pre-pandemic numbers, these numbers are very good. Compared with April 2019 numbers, April 2019, the employed were only 27.04%. Million jobs. The employment rate was 60.3%. Unemployment rate was 4.4% in 2019. So these are substantial improvements even beyond where it was pre-pandemic. So in that sense, these numbers, I think, should be something that we should be somewhat happy about. But these are, as I said, in terms of raw numbers, these are fairly good. But if you look at the quality of jobs, then we still haven't caught up completely to the pre-pandemic period. The age groups, all age groups rose, their employment rate rose compared to last year. But if you compare it to pre-pandemic, the 40s age group has fallen a little bit. And half of the job increases came from over 60s group. And the largest category with job increases are health and social services, where it gained 230,000 jobs. The next largest was manufacturing, which is good, but only 132,000 jobs. So because health and social services jobs tend to be government finance jobs, these seem to indicate that job increases are largely due to government financing. So what happens if the government support ends? The likely scenario is that a lot of these jobs will disappear because they're not self-supporting, sustainable jobs. If we look at full-time jobs of over 36 hours per week, in April 2022, it was 21.74 million jobs. But in 2019, April, it was 21.78 million jobs. So it's almost the same, but a little bit below. So again, it does seem like most of the job increases came from part-time jobs, which increased to 5.88 million in 2022, April. But 2019, April, it was only 4.9 million jobs. So a lot of the job increases came from government-financed part-time jobs. And again, these jobs may not be sustainable if the government financing disappears.
Right. And will that government financing disappear now that we have a new administration? The previous administration, the Moon administration, had stressed jobs for the elderly for government-financed jobs as well.
I'm not sure if this government is going to be brave enough to get rid of those jobs.
Right.
Now, in some sense, these jobs are part of a welfare policy. It does give some income to over 60s. Korea does have very bad record when it comes to poverty for people over 60s. Problem is, as I said, it's probably not sustainable. So what we really want are more private sector jobs for these people, which can be supported using the market economy. But in order to do that, we're probably going to have to change a lot of laws, change a lot of regulations. And this government has promised they will do that. I'm not sure if it comes to the actual structural changes which are needed, whether this government is powerful enough or brave enough to do it.
Sure, it's easier said than done, really.
Basically.
Speaking of the new administration, the new government proposed a 59 trillion won supplementary budget this week, 36 trillion of which will be used to stabilize prices and support small business owners hit by the COVID-19 pandemic, primarily in the form of relief funds. Now, this is the largest ever extra budget, and the government said it would finance it without issuing bonds. The proposal has now been submitted to the National Assembly for approval, and we'll see how that goes. But, Professor, what do you make of this proposal?
Okay, well, before we go on whether, in terms of economics, whether this extra budget was needed or not, I think I should emphasize that this extra budget was basically political in nature.
Okay.
I think political consideration came first, and what economic consideration there is came afterwards as sort of a justification for the money that they wanted to spend in the first place. And I should also emphasize that this is not just the fault of the current administration, the current ruling party, but also the opposition party, because, well, they promised basically something similar. And even now, some people in the opposition party are saying the extra budget should be larger. Though there are some people in the opposition party who are saying that the extra budget should be smaller because we may be hit with a recession later this year. But anyhow, of the 59 trillion won, 36.4 trillion is direct government spending, central government spending increase. 23 trillion won is additional payment to regional government and educational funds, which are required by law when you have budget leftover and you have supplementary spending. Much of the financing for this supplementary budget came from unexpected tax income, which was 53.3 trillion won. This year and 61.4 trillion won last year. So in that sense, because it's being financed entirely by tax receipts and we don't have to issue extra debt, or it may not be as painful as what some analysts feared in a few months ago.
Right.
But still, there are some concerns that it'll add to inflation because it'll add extra government spending. Mm. Now, there's a couple of arguments against that. The first is that this money, while it is going to, most of it is going to small businesses and people who have impacted by the coronavirus, it's probably going to be used mostly to pay off debt.
Right.
So the money in the end may end up not with the small business owners, but rather with the financial institutions.
Mm.
And that may feed into perhaps asset inflation, stock markets and housing markets. It may not increase spending.
Mm.
But I tend, because it is not being financed by the deficit, and because the coronavirus has impacted so much on the lower income households and microbusiness owners, I think perhaps reducing the debt may be a good thing.
Right.
And to the extent that we will have extra spending, it may impact on higher inflation.
Mm.
But I don't think the effect is going to be that big, because most of the reason for Korean inflation is coming from abroad rather than domestically.
Sure.
So increase in domestic spending may increase inflation a little bit, but the main forces, the main causes behind inflation will come from, still come from outside Korea. And I think a good way to think about it is the Bank of Korea should be taking care of the international aspects, international capital markets and inflation. And the government should be concerned about keeping up the real economy, because our first quarter GDP figures show that our consumption and investment were going down.
Mm.
So I think having at least some strong government spending, since we already have a very high budget anyway, may be a good idea. But there is concern that it will, even though I don't think it'll be that big, it will increase inflation by somewhat.
Right. So overall, you do believe it could be beneficial for the economy and it might not affect the inflation that much. But then you said this budget is perhaps more political in nature than actually being necessary, especially looking at it from the point of an economist, right?
Right. Now, Korea already has a super budget. If we don't use the extra budget, the spending has gone up by more than 8% this year from last year. So we do already do have a very large spending component. My best what-if scenario would be that they use the they rearrange the existing budget so that it will try to increase the spending component. And because you're not adding that much extra spending, you're just shifting it, it should not affect inflation all that much. That would have been my best scenario. But again, this extra budget came from political consideration. So if you're going to have it anyway, I just hope they use it effectively.
On the concerns over inflation, we got the U.S. inflation figures this week for last month. U.S. consumer prices rose at an annual pace of 8.3% in April. While that was, again, staggeringly high, it was below the 8.5% year-over-year surge in March, which was the highest in more than 40 years. Is this then a sign, perhaps, that the U.S. inflation has peaked? Or is there something that the numbers aren't showing us?
I think it's giving us mixed signals, and that's what makes the U.S. financial market so nervous.
Mm.
As you mentioned, it was 5.3% over a 12-month basis. They expected 8.1%, so it came in a bit higher than expectations, but a bit lower than where it was last year. But if you look at the monthly figures, it was actually a lot lower in April than it was in March. It was only 0.3% over the month of April. But what it concerns me is core inflation. We've been saying that inflation is mostly due to grain and oil prices. And what core inflation does is it strips away the foodstuff and energy, and we're left with prices which change over longer periods than those food and energy, which can be very volatile. And on a monthly basis, the core inflation in the month of April was 0.6%. which was higher than the headline core headline inflation over the month of April. So that seems to mean that while the oil prices and grain prices are stabilizing somewhat, the other prices of other goods are rising perhaps even faster. So that may mean that the effect of oil and grain prices are now spreading toward the rest of the economy, and the labor shortage that we've been they've been talking about in the United States, wage increases are also feeding into the economy. And especially the April report emphasized the increase in prices of shelter, rents, housing prices, and so on. So the worrying signal is that inflation may be spreading toward other sectors of the economy. So while the oil and grain prices may be coming under control, the inflation may be becoming more embedded.
Very briefly, we've only got about 30 seconds. So what does this mean for the Bank of Korea's rate decision this month?
Well, it's more likely now that I think the Fed will raise the interest rate by 0.5% in June. That means Korea must raise the interest rate by 0.25 percentage points at the very least in May, and may have to continue to raise the interest rates a lot more often than BOK wants to.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there, Professor Yang. As always, thank you for your analysis.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 54.16 points, or 2.12% on Friday, ending the week at 2,604.24. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 19.42 points, or 2.33%, to close at 853.08. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 4.41 against the dollar, ending the week at 1,284.21. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We move on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea Today. And for that, we have our regular contributor for this segment, Walter Lee, joining us in the studio. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jung. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Happy Friday, Walter.
Happy Friday.
So what topics have you brought for us today?
Okay, so first we'll talk about major crypto exchange Binance's decision to delist the South Korean-made cryptocurrency Luna. We'll also find out what former President Moon Jae-in did on his first day out since his retirement. And finally, we'll discuss Finland's possible application for NATO membership.
Okay, so we start with a major piece of news from the cryptocurrency industry. Can you tell us more?
Yes, so Binance, the world's largest crypto exchange, has delisted Luna, the sister cryptocurrency of the algorithmic stablecoin Terra US dollar developed by Seoul-based Terraform Labs. Binance announced the move on Friday, saying it made the decision to protect investors from the cryptocurrency's excessive volatility. According to the website CoinMarketCap, which provides data on cryptocurrencies, Luna price plunged over 99% from Thursday to stand at well below $1 on Friday morning.
Yes, the fall has been eye-wateringly swift and deep. It's been pretty incredible. And this despite Terraform Labs actively having sought ways to save Luna and Terra USD from complete collapse, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So such efforts came after Luna's price plunge from $85 a week ago to trade at around 4 cents on Thursday, making it nearly worthless. The sister cryptocurrency was designed to help Terra US dollar, or UST, retain its dollar peg with a mint and burn mechanism. So this means investors can swap UST for $1 worth of Luna and vice versa.
This latest announcement must have sent investors into a frenzy, Walter.
Shortly after the news of Binance delisting Luna came out, many investors that had purchased the token endlessly posted complaints on communities related to the nation's cryptocurrency trading. Some stressed the need for the head of Terraform Labs, Kwon Do-hyun, to be investigated. There was an incident on Thursday evening when the unidentified person, presumably an angry investor, rang the doorbell of Kwon's residence in Seoul in the Sangsu-dong area and asked if Kwon was home when his wife answered the bell. This person left the scene shortly after ringing the doorbell, and Kwon's wife immediately called the police. She and her family are receiving police protection upon her request.
Yes, that must have been terrifying for them. And we, of course, do not condone in any way for his family to be harassed and terrorized in this sort of manner. Meanwhile, what is worrying is that it's not entirely clear how this happened. There were meant to be safeguards in place. Terra USD was a so-called stable coin. Despite the promises made about the future of cryptocurrencies, these sorts of incidents show perhaps that there is still a long way to go. And it is also a warning to invest at your own risk. Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us next?
Yes, so former President Moon Jae-in took to social media on Thursday to share what he did on his first day after stepping down from office earlier on Monday. Moon has settled in Yongsan, South Gyeongsang Province. And in a message posted on his Facebook and Twitter accounts, the former president said he visited his parents' grave. The graves are located at the cemetery owned by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Busan, which is near Pyeongsan village, where Moon has taken up residence.
Yes, there had been a lot of people wondering how he will live his post-presidential life, and he has started with a somber and solemn note. Did the former president do anything else on Thursday?
He also visited Tongdosa Temple, which is the temple of the nation's largest Buddhist sect, the Chogye Order. There, Moon said he had tea with the Venerable Tsongpa, the supreme patriarch of the order. Moon wrote that the temple is surrounded by beautiful scenery and is a place where good energy is felt, given that it's served a venue for countless prayers for years. Citing that his house is right next to the temple's fence, the former president said his friend and architect, Sung Hyo-sang, who built his Yongsan residence, referred to the structure of the temple in designing his house.
Did Moon, by any chance, unveil any plans he has for the future?
Not exactly. So in Thursday's post, he only said he has yet to complete settling into his new house, adding that his five dogs and one cat have yet to adjust to their new home. But other than that, he's doing fine. In a separate message posted on two accounts titled Former President Moon, Jae-in's Secretariat of Pyeongsan Village, Moon's aides said that they will share what the former president is up to at Pyeongsan Village, as well as upload some messages written by Moon.
Yes, many will be watching to see if he becomes involved in any sort of political moves, but unsurprisingly for now, he is keeping his activities relatively low-key. Okay, let's move on to our final story for today. What do you have for us?
Yes, so Finland's leaders have stressed the need for their country to promptly apply for NATO membership. According to the Associated Press, the Nordics country's president, Sauli Niinisto, and Prime Minister Sanna Marin said in a joint statement on Thursday that Finland must apply for NATO membership without delay, adding that the membership would strengthen their country's security. Now, the two leaders said that as a NATO member, Finland would strengthen the entire defense alliance while expressing hope that the national steps needed to make this decision will be taken rapidly within the next few days.
This is quite a turn of events, as the Nordic nation has long maintained the status of a neutral country to try and maintain friendly ties with Russia, right?
That's correct. So with Thursday's statement, Finland has virtually given up that status after 74 years. The country, which is a member of the European Union and shares a 1,300-kilometre border with Russia, had maintained neutrality, but began to steadily strengthen cooperation with NATO after Russia invaded and subsequently annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine in March 2014. Then, when Russia invaded Ukraine earlier this February, more and more Finnish people called for their country to join the North Atlantic Alliance. A local survey on the topic found that 76% of all Finns support NATO membership, while only 12% are opposed of it.
How has the latest statement been received by other countries, including Russia?
Well, the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, which are already NATO members, hailed the Finnish move. According to the Associated Press, neighbouring Sweden, which is a neutral country, is likely to decide on seeking the same membership in the coming days. The Kremlin said in a statement that Finland's accession to NATO would inflict serious damage to relations between the two countries, as well as stability and security in Northern Europe. And it then warned that it will be forced to take retaliatory steps of military, technical, and other characteristics in order to counter the emerging threats to its national security.
Yeah, so we're continuing to see a significant shift in the geopolitical landscape due to Russia's actions in Ukraine. We'll leave it there for today's Career Trending. Thank you for those stories, Walter, and we will talk to you again next time.
See you next week.
We've now come to our Friday feature, Movie Spotlight, where we discuss and review some of the latest releases at the Korean box office and online. This week, we only have one critic with us, but that just means we get a double dose of his charms. Jason Bechervais is with us in the studio. Jason, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. A double dose of me.
Yes,
How
indeed.
How good is that?
Okay, so a classic combo of one local and one international release to look at this week. Let's start with the more high-profile international release. It is the British spy drama called Operation Mincemeat, or in Korean, Mincemeat Jakjeon. It is set during the Second World War and it stars Colin Firth in the lead role. So, Jason, what can you tell us about this film?
Yeah, it's based on Ben McIntyre's 2010 novel of the same name. It's an account of a British deception operation in 1943. So during World War II, when members of British intelligence took a corpse belonging to a tramp and put it in the ocean off the coast of Spain with the intention that the Germans would get hold of the documents in his possession. Now, this would then convince the Nazis, they hope, that the British and its allies would launch an offensive in Greece as opposed to Sicily. Now, this is very important because Allied troops needed to take Sicily if they were to turn the tide of the war, but it was heavily defended by German troops, so essentially getting the Germans to go to Greece.
Right, and this is based on real events, isn't it?
It's based on real events. It was an operation that was authorised by Churchill and involved a very small unit of very skilled intelligence officers led by the pair Ewan Montagu and Charles Cholamondeley. In the film, they're played by Colin Firth and Matthew McFadden, respectively. Other figures include Ian Fleming, the writer of James Bond, of course, while in the film, two female operatives acted by Kelly MacDonald and Penelope MacDonald are centrist to this rather ingenious, or some would argue ridiculous, plan of deception. Also stars the ever fantastic Jason Isaacs as Admiral John Godfrey, who advised Churchill. Now, M, for all those Bond fans out there, was actually based on Godfrey. I didn't know that until I watched this film. And it's directed by John Madden, who made Shakespeare in Love, Miss Sloane, and written by Michelle Ashford.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a bit of a sleuthing going on there.
Yeah.
Quite a few connections to James Bond as well, as you mentioned.
Absolutely.
But I understand this is more of a drama as opposed to an action thriller as such. Something more akin to Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the film by Thomas Alfredson, based on John le Carré's 1974 novel.
Yeah, it's a spy drama. I mean, it's very much focused, on dialogue and the interactions and the relationships between the members in the team, particularly kind of four central members, the two guys I was talking about, and also the two female operatives as well. You know what? I actually love this film. I think it's I think it's terrific. It's so well acted, and production designs are fantastic too. I just love a good, you know, espionage drama. I like thrillers as well, but I think dramas for me that are, I mean, it's so much kind of depends on the dialogue and the interaction between the characters rather than the set pieces. And I think that here just, it just works really well. I mean, you mentioned Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which was, it's based on a novel by John le Carré, you know, fantastic novel. And he was also an operative as well, wasn't he? There's this focus on literature in the film as well. At one point, one of the operatives talks about being surrounded by writers and these references almost to James Bond. And it was a film that I really, really enjoyed. And it right. wasn't an event that I knew anything about, really. If looking at current day events as well, given what's happening in Ukraine and Russia, and there's talk in the film of the so-called free world, and I think it resonates today as well.
So, as you said, less on action pieces, but still a fun watch.
Oh yeah, it's a lot of humour in there. It's not too serious, so very well written by Michelle Ashford.
The film is available on Netflix in North America, but it was released here in theatres. Is it a film worth then seeing on the big screen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's beautifully shot, so I wouldn't want to watch this on Netflix. Although I'd like to see it again, and I've seen it on the big screen, so I would happily see it on my home TV now. But certainly the first kind of time I watched this film, I'm glad I saw it. On a big screen at my local multiplex. Like I said earlier, in terms of the production values, the cinematography, the music's fantastic too. It's got a terrific cast, and who's not in a good mood for an espionage drama or thriller? And this has all the right ingredients, and highly recommended.
Do you think it'll work for a Korean audience as well? Korean audiences do have a tendency to like British films. So
That's true. We've seen
huge successes with films like Kingsman, Dunkirk, working title rom-coms. They all do well.
Yeah, it tends to be certain films. Dunkirk is, of course, Christopher Nolan. And then you've got the working title rom-coms, which I think romanticised British life. and then you've got Kingsman, which is this really wacky film that actually works really well. I'm talking about the first one especially. Mm. This film, there's just so much focus on the dialogue, and especially in the second half, it does get a little bit convoluted. You've got these... spies working in various different countries and for various different governments as well. And so it does get a little bit confusing. That being said, though, yeah, like I said earlier, recommended. And I hope some audiences here go and watch it on the big screen. But I don't see it being this big hit like some of the other films you mentioned.
Okay. Still, two big thumbs up. Fantastic.
Yeah, two thumbs up. I wasn't expecting to enjoy it so much. And good
Let's
film.
Let's move on to our Korean release now, which is the family drama Piggyback. Obuba in Korean. It stars Jung Jun-ho. It was released with this month being family month, 가정의 달, in mind. Can you tell us about this film? Is it a movie suitable for all ages then?
Well, it'd like to be. It would like to be suitable like for all ages, but unfortunately, I don't think it's really going to attract many. I'll get onto that. It's a bit of a stinker of a film. I was like, shall I be diplomatic? But I think there are times when you need to be brutally honest, and I think in terms of how this film has been made, it's very poorly produced. Anyway, it's directed by Choi Jong-hak. He's made a couple of films, including Think Like Dogs in 2020. The big name actor here is Jung Jun-ho. He was in some of the Marion and the Mafia films, also My Boss, My Teacher. He plays this captain of this boat. Essentially, he's he's the sole person kind of keeping it going. And it's called Piggyback Ferry. It's based in Busan. Now, he's very protective of his family. But, they all got their own kind of things that they want to do. He's got his younger brother who suddenly announces his engagement to a much younger woman, and he gets suspicious, and rightly so. There are these Chinese Koreans involved. And then his very young boy, his son, falls in love. And then one day his ship is also in danger of being taken away. And that's all you need to know, really. I mean, the film is almost 2 hours, like an hour too long, in my opinion. it's a real stretch to fit that 110 minutes or so narrative.
Can you explain a bit more then? Why is it such a stinker?
Where do I start? First of all, in terms of who it's targeted at. I mean, the jokes in the film, it's the kind of film I almost take my son to go and see. I mean, the acting is so dramatic. It's so kind of over the top.
Right.
And so some of the slapstick humor, I think, could work for a very young age group. And then there might be those who are much older that might enjoy some of the melodrama. Melodrama has had a long tradition in Korean cinema. We see that in some big budget films, Along with the Gods or Miracle in Cell Number 7. You even see melodrama in Bong Joon-ho's films. But I mean, these days, in heavy doses, you tend to see it in kind of daytime TV. Mm. But here, it's just so over the top. So I'm not quite sure who it's targeted at. And then in terms of the production values, they're just so bad. The lighting is patchy. The editing is all over the place, and just where they place the camera as well. I mean, there's a shot early on in the film that's set on a rooftop, and then the camera's kind of spinning around. It feels rather nauseating, and it's not really that well put together. And then it just suddenly just hones in on a cloud, and I'm like, okay, interesting. And then later on, there's just some real trouble, I think, in terms of some of the framing. It's just very, very sloppy. And there's music in almost every scene, you know, to drive, you know, up the emotion. So it's heavily reliant on music. Which I think underscores the many problems that it has. It's very daft. And sometimes you could be in the mood for this kind of film. Maybe there are certain audiences that would enjoy this film, but I would guess there are not that many. And maybe I'm being too unkind, and I apologize. this film, the production values associated with Korean cinema are so high. I've seen student films that have been better produced than this.
Wow, so two big thumbs down for this one, really. Perhaps a bit of a low-key local release as well this week, especially because there is a major Korean release coming out next week, right? The Outlaws sequel, The Roundup, Pomjae Gochi 2.
Yeah, so they had their press screen earlier on, earlier on this week and in Seoul, and the reaction so far seems pretty positive. The reservations also picking up. Yeah, this is a big test for the Korean film industry because for months it's been pretty much dormant, and cinemas are just... Yeah, they've been open, but it's been very much kind of Hollywood or Marvel fare that's really attracting the crowd. And now the Korean films need to do the same, and can they? We'll have to wait and see. I am optimistic. It is a big test, and we've got a number of films that are coming out over the next few weeks, which hopefully will lure back the crowd. So we've got Kim Amin's Hansam, we've got Choi Dong-hoon's Alien, and we've got the Cannes films as well, Park Chang-wook's Decision to Leave, and Kurita's Broker. So, watch this space. Hopefully I will certainly be here, one would hope, to talk about some of these films.
And are we going to get a review of The Roundup next week?
Yes, I'll watch it next week. I'm looking forward to catching it.
Okay, so we've got that to look forward to. We'll leave it there for this week, though. Jason, thank you for coming in today, doing a double shift, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you. See you then. Bye-bye.
We've now come to the very last segment of the week, next week from Seoul, where we preview some notable events coming up in the week ahead. And to tell us what to look out for is our staff editor, Richard Larkin, who has joined us now in the studio. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first thing we need to look out for next week?
Well, President Yoon Suk-yeol will visit the southwestern city of Gwangju next week to commemorate the 42nd anniversary of the democratic uprising in the city. The visit will mark Yoon's first trip outside of Seoul since taking office on Tuesday, and he will attend a state memorial ceremony at the May 18th National Cemetery. For people who don't know, in May of 1980, people in Gwangju stood up against a military junta led by John Doohan. Martial law troops and paratroopers were deployed to seal off the city and carry out a brutal crackdown on protesters. To this day, we have yet to find out what exactly happened during the 10 days of the uprising, including the exact number of people who were killed by the military. This will not be the first time Yoon has gone to the cemetery, as late last year, the then presidential candidate made the visit and said he always believed in the need to stipulate the spirit of the democracy uprising in the constitution. He also apologised for praising former dictator Jun Doohan in the past, who ordered the suppression of the activists.
Right, not only is it significant that this memorial event is going to be his first visit out of Seoul as president, but it's always particularly symbolic when a conservative leader attends this event. However, when he visited Gwangju on the campaign trail, he was met with fierce protests. We'll see what the situation is like when he does visit this time next Wednesday. Let's move on to some more news for next week. What else do you have for us?
So health authorities under the new government will discuss when to lift the remaining COVID-19 quarantine rules next week, as the country has seen a decline in average daily cases for 7 consecutive weeks. This also comes after the recent downgrade of the virus infectious disease level from the highest class 1 to 2. According to the Vice Health Minister, Yi Gi-il, following a comprehensive review, the nation could consider lifting mandatory testing and 7-day quarantine for confirmed patients from May 23rd, and added that the weekly average of daily cases should remain below 100,000. In the first meeting of the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures headquarters this week, officials have discussed the 100-day COVID-19 response task put forth by Yoon's transition teams last month.
Yes, lifting of the mandatory quarantine for those infected will be a huge step indeed. OK, and today we have saved arguably the biggest for last, especially as it's coming up towards the end of next week. And that is, of course, Richard.
President Yoon Suk-yeol is set to hold a summit with the President of the United States, Joe Biden, on May 21st. Biden will be visiting South Korea for the first time since taking office in January of last year and will be meeting Yoon for the first time. The leaders plan to hold talks on ways to advance the South Korea-US alliance, strengthen cooperation on North Korea policies, and share views on key regional issues. During his stay, Biden is also expected to visit the joint security area of Panmunjom on the border between the South and the North, and will also meet former President Moon Jae-in at the US leader's request.
Yes, Biden will be touching down next week, Friday, and holding that summit with Yoon on Saturday. So all that to look forward to next week. Richard, thank you for that roundup, and we'll see you again on Monday.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And that's where we wrap things up for the week. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back on Monday, so we hope you join us again then to continue to get your daily dose of Korean news analysis. Till then, we hope you have a great weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.